From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 37 for Friday, the 5th of August, 2011. On the show this week...
We thought that it was kind of quite shocking, actually, in publishing, that there's no way for readers to have any kind of direct say in what does or doesn't get published.
Writing a book can be an expensive business, so why not ask the public to fund you instead of a publisher? That's what crowdfunding service Unbound is aiming to let you do, and this week we're going to discover how it works and who it's working for. We'll also look at the latest in facial recognition technology for chimps in a welcome bit of monkey news, and what happened to the Swedish chap who decided it was a brilliant idea to build a nuclear reactor in his kitchen. You're about to find out as we explore the week in Wired News. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in Condé Nast's nuclear bunker this week, senior staff writer Duncan Geer.
Hello.
And hello. And associate editor Olivia _ Solon.
Hello.
Liv, I wanted to point out something that I didn't tell you yet. You really scared me last night.
Really?
Yeah. For everyone who wasn't there, which is to say everyone except Duncan, we had some sort of Pimm's and wine on a fake beach on South Bank near the Thames.
It was lovely.
It was delightful. Yeah. And Liv told me this theory she has about giving birth to babies in like Joey pouches, but for humans.
Yeah.
Thanks for the mental image.
It's not about, well, it's a marsupial birth process that I think could be implemented in humans.
Using kind of front-facing backpack type things.
Yeah, whereby you'd give birth to something at a very young age and put it into a bag and grow it there contained in amniotic fluid. And you could take it off at night, plug it in.
Liv, honestly, it's the most disturbing thing I've heard on a fake beach on South Bank.
Okay, well...
You're not up for the idea? I mean, you wouldn't have to anyway, but...
No, you would, because the point is that then a man could carry the baby around.
Hmm, not convinced. Let us know what you think.
I think it sounds like a great idea.
I love it. I love it as a weird way of...
You can take it off at night, or, you know, if you...
Plug it in, clean up the amniotic fluid in the morning.
As you do.
Wake up, put it back on, wear it on your front.
Please take that to Dragon's Den.
Okay.
Take it to Dragon's Den. I would just love to see that. Later on, we're going to talk to Dan Kieran, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, who is one of the co-founders of Unbound. And also Terry Jones, who people may realise is from Monty Python, who is the first person to use this new book publishing service. And Katie's got a fab feature after we get through the news. So listen out for that. And the aforementioned news, let us get on with it. Duncan, Vince Cable's been doing some stuff.
He has.
And also some things. Tell me about his stuff and things.
He's announced his support for the recommendations in the Hargreaves Review of Intellectual Property, which we discussed on, I can't remember which episode it was, many podcasts ago.
It was quite a while ago. And one of the things that we talked about is this idea of legalizing format shifting. And this is now going to be, hopefully, law.
Yeah, at the moment, if you rip a CD to MP3, you are format shifting and breaking the law.
It's just, it's one of these things that's existed for a while. And everyone does it, and the industry turns a blind eye to it, and it's totally daft that it's actually technically illegal.
Completely, and that's kind of the point, really. They want to change copyright law in ways that the public consumers consider to be reasonable use of these things. They're not going to legalize file sharing, and you know, let you go and just send files off to whoever you want, but you will be able to make personal copies of your content.
And about damn time. And what else has come out of this?
They're creating exceptions for parody within copyright law, making it more explicitly permissible to sort of parody a song and have that not immediately get taken down from YouTube, for example. They're also going to make it easier for scientists to data mine journals to develop new research. But perhaps the most important thing in the proposal, and not something that got an awful lot of column inches, but I think is absolutely crucial, is they want to create a digital copyright exchange where licenses for digital content can be really easily bought and sold.
What does that mean? What does that mean for me and Liv? Tell Liv. She doesn't look like she knows what it means.
I don't know what it means, Duncan. Tell me what it means.
Explain, please.
It means that if you want to start up, or if you've got a great idea for, say, a digital music service.
Which I have.
And you want to get licenses to use content legally and you want to pay people for it. At the moment, you have to sign at least two licenses for every single song that you want to include on that service.
Oh, I haven't got time to do that.
So if you want 10 million tracks, that means licenses, two for each song, one for the actual recording, one for the song structure itself, for every single song that you want to do.
So the knock-on effect really for people like me and Liv is that people who have ideas for these businesses can set up their business ideas far more easily because they don't
have the
overhead of signing all these deals.
Yeah. So, I mean, it took Spotify 2 years to build up the licenses that it needed to launch. It took the BBC 5 years to negotiate all the licenses to launch iPlayer. That's ridiculous.
But hang on, I don't really understand still how it works. You put up you say this stuff can be easily, you can easily exchange the copyright via this platform. Like, what's the...
There's still an awful lot of debate about how it will be structured. The wording in the thing was very vague, but basically what it will be is, on the one hand, you'll have people who own the copyrights.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've got the people that want the copyrights. And between the two, you've got this kind of elaborate matchmaking service
okay.
that connects one to the other very, very easy, very, very simply. You know, a brilliant solution would be if you log on, select the content you want to get licenses for, and then you are presented with a bill, and that's it.
I'm sorry, but the government is definitely not the best place to set this sort of thing up.
The government aren't setting it up.
Who would set it up?
They're talking about an agency setting it up that's independent. The government, you're completely right, shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
But they can say that this is something that should be set up and would make, you know, add significant value to the UK economy
yeah.
to make it easier to deal in digital content.
But this wouldn't just be about music, right?
No, this is about all kinds of things. It wouldn't even be limited to just audiovisual content. Books could fall under it, publishing, all kinds of things. And nailing down exactly how that's going to take place is the next step and a very, very difficult step.
Yeah.
Well, this is good news. On the topic of the format shifting issue, though, we had a little poll on the website on Wired for the story that covered all this news. And 96% of readers voted yes, format shifting should be legal in the UK. So there's a clearly strong desire there.
Although I'd be interested to see who voted no.
Yeah.
People whose opinions don't count for anything, in my opinion. Anyway, let's move on. Foxconn, which is the company that manufactures iPods in China, amongst other various products, is hiring 1 million robots to complement... acquiring and installing
building
1 million robots by 2014 to help complement its human body workforce,
which is already quite massive.
They have 1 million people. They are the
it's
biggest private employer in China, Foxconn. And they've been in the news a lot over the last couple of years, but they've got this explosive growth and they handle so much for so many people. And clearly the massive costs that even a small rise in labor charges can have when you have 1 million people working for you is enough to make them think, hang about, we should probably be employing some machines to work 24/7. Now, what's really funny about this story is that the news that they were going to be employing 1 million, hiring, whatever,
yeah,
creating 1 million robots, was announced at the workers' dance party by the company's founder and chairman.
I imagine that's going to have been a cheery night. I
mean, could you imagine that?
How,
you know, have a great party, everyone. P.S. We're replacing you with machines.
Yeah, I love it. It's like we're going to put some machines in place to replace some of the workforce. How many of them? 1 million. How many of you are there? 1 million.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't look too rosy. But by 2014, you know, the rate of growth, they will have significantly more employees anyway.
Yeah, sure.
And at the moment, they have 10,000 robots working for them, operating under their roof, whatever, Liv.
Yeah.
And they want that to be 300,000 by next year and 1 million by 2014. So pretty huge.
How long before they unionize?
Well, we've been having this conversation about the inevitable robot uprising. And honestly, if it's going to happen anywhere first, it's going to be China.
It's going to be Foxconn's factories.
Definitely. Let's move across different seas and onto a different continent. Iceland, Duncan, has... it's got a first draft of its crowdsourced constitution for the government.
Before we go there, what continent is Iceland in? Because it's on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, so I guess it must be Europe, technically.
My geography is so unbelievably awful, I don't even want to pretend
yeah,
that
Duncan,
I know.
This is definitely... You would be the best one to take a guess at that.
I'd guess Europe. But the councillors in Iceland have turned in the first draft of a completely new constitution for the country, which has been predominantly crowdsourced by its population.
And how exactly did they get this information from the population? Because it wasn't just like a postal opinion poll, was it?
No, definitely not. More than 94% of Iceland's population, which is just 320,000 people, so it's not huge, have internet access at home. And those people were reached out to via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Flickr, all sorts of places by a 25-member council.
This is really interesting to me because Iceland has been using the same old Danish constitution for about, 60 years, 70 years?
Yeah, since they gained independence in 1944, they've been using the same constitution as Denmark. But now they want to change that since the economic crisis when all of their banks collapsed and there were massive protests and everything. They now want to make let the public have a little bit more of a say as to what the values of the country are and how it's going to be governed.
Fundamentally, pretty much all democratic constitutions are crowdsourced to a certain degree.
I mean, not over Twitter.
Definitely not over Twitter, but you know, they do incorporate the feelings of the masses.
I guess the United States one isn't so much because that was just written down by the founding fathers when they started the country.
No,
but then they made
they were just
of
some
changes.
Dudes. Well, yeah. I mean, they've all been subject to democratic oversight.
I do like the reductionist view of how America was founded. Oh, it was just some dudes writing down on a bit of paper how the country should be run.
That's basically what happened.
It's the founding of an entire nation.
That's all you have to do. It's very easy.
I would love to start a country by writing on a scrap of paper.
But what?
I'm doing one right now.
Have you just started a country? What's it called?
Live World. A world. I've created a world, not a country.
Livonia. There was a country called Livonia once upon a time, I think. It's now Lithuania or Latvia or somewhere around there.
No, that's not the one I've founded.
I was going to say something actually relevant to the discussion. I was going to say the citizens in the constitution turned out to be predominantly concerned with fairly web-savvy topics, as you might imagine. They were really into net neutrality, transparency, and also freedom of access. That were the most important things that came out.
Well, the most important things for the entire country's constitution was net neutrality.
They were very, much more concerned about that than, say, they were about how livestock
issues.
Is treated. And
well, you know
that.
What?
There aren't that many human rights issues in Iceland.
Let's move on very quickly onto the topic of internet, but a bit closer to home, London, and Wi-Fi.
Our home, anyway. It might not be your home.
As I've said, if you exist outside the M25, you don't exist to me. I'm joking. You exist more. Liv, tell me about Wi-Fi, please.
Right. Well, Boris Johnson, in 2010, made the ridiculous claim that every lamppost and every bus stop will one day, very soon, and before the 2012 Olympics, be Wi-Fi enabled.
Why would I want a lamppost with Wi-Fi?
Don't know.
How about if you're walking down the street and you pull out your phone and you want to see something?
I've got 3G. So how's this going to play out?
Well, I went and meet up with Colvier Ranger, who is the Director of Environment and Digital London, who's on Team Boris, basically. And he confirmed that although they wouldn't be putting Wi-Fi routers on every single lamppost and every single bus stop, they will be rolling out Wi-Fi on bus stops throughout the capital before 2012.
And Virgin Media, I know, has been in talks to give the entirety of London blanket free Wi-Fi as well.
Yeah, I mean, the details are pretty hazy on that one, but they were talking to investors, I think, this week, and they were saying that they were looking to put the Wi-Fi in their cable cabinets.
And it's kind of, it's interesting what you were saying about it being an insane pledge for Boris Johnson to make, but it's not much more insane than Kennedy saying, hey, let's go to the moon.
But within 2 years to install all of that infrastructure, and not just, you know, across Greater London, which is obviously, you know, it's not just the small part of London that we tend to work and live in.
It's going to be quite a task. But given the moves that the government has been making towards Digital Britain and getting Britain online, I imagine he'll find an awful lot of backing and funding for a project of that nature.
Yeah, but I don't think it'll be on every lamppost. The other thing that Colvier told me, which was really cool, was that they're going to be releasing the data, making the iBus data open. The iBus technology is the thing that tells TfL where all the buses are at any one time, and they use it to put on those little screens you sometimes get at bus stops, and also to trigger the announcements that you have in the buses saying you're about to reach, you know, what do they say?
They say, the next stop is mile end.
Exactly.
Mind the gap, please.
Yeah. So that information is currently held by TfL. But they're very shortly going to be releasing that. So people can develop apps, which means you can have an app that would tell you exactly when your bus is going to arrive.
I think this is amaze bears.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
It's fantastic.
We're in agreement then.
Good.
I like to be in agreement on these things. Do we have any idea, by the way, of when this would happen? I mean, a couple of years, you said, but is that likely?
Which one?
For the iBus.
Oh, the iBus? No, much sooner. Much sooner. This is one of the highest priority data releases within the London Data Store. And so I imagine this year, for sure.
Well, I need to release an ad with high priorities. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the guy who built a nuclear reactor in his kitchen.
Registration for the Wire 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
So, the chap in Sweden, we had a story on the website this week about this guy, and he decided it was a great idea to build a nuclear reactor in his kitchen and blog the process. Got him into a spot of bother, didn't it, Donuts? Duncan?
A little bit of trouble, yeah. He'd been interested in nuclear physics since he was a teenager and managed to obtain some radioactive material from overseas, I presume over the internet or something, and also by taking apart a domestic fire alarm. I don't know if the listeners will know, but there's generally radioactive material in most fire alarms. But anyway, he came to the attention of the police after he got in touch with Sweden's nuclear radiation authority and said, so how legal is it to build a nuclear reactor in your kitchen? And they said, not sure. We're going to come to your apartment and measure radiation levels to find out. And of course, they turned up with the police and arrested him and put him in jail. And
that's, don't you think that's a little bit like somebody else saying, how legal is it to stick a knife in someone and then coming round to investigate whether the guy is breathing or not on the floor?
I think to be fair, nuclear radiation laws are fairly less well known than stabbing laws. But the point is that they've charged him with some offences against the Radiation Safety Act in Sweden, and he's been released for the moment on bail pending a hearing.
He must be a pretty smart guy. I mean, these are the kind of guys that you want to hire, not put away. Because if this guy can build up his own nuclear reactor in his house, this is the kind of guy you want working for the government, even if it's just to keep an eye on them, because he's clearly a smart dude.
He told his local paper that he didn't even think he'd be able to get any power out of it anyway. He was just doing it for the fun of it. He said, to get it to generate electricity, you'd need a turbine and a generator. And that's very difficult to build yourself.
He sounds like a smart guy. I think if you need a nuclear scientist, you should hire him when he's finished being in trouble. Mike, in the comments on our story, had an interesting point to say. He said, it's not illegal to build a reactor, but it's illegal to possess radioactive material. So you can build yourself a reactor, but you can't fuel it. I love the fact that that's how the law works. Sure, build a reactor, just don't put any nuclear fuel in it. Amazing.
Then is it a reactor without the nuclear fuel?
I don't know.
It's a reactor. It isn't reacting.
Yeah.
Chimps is our next topic.
Yep, monkey news.
Tell me a chimpanzee
ape news.
Tell me some monkey news, Liv.
Well, researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, wow, that's a mouthful, and the University of Bristol and the Fraunhofer Institute have teamed up to create facial recognition for great apes and elephants.
Why would people want to be using facial recognition to, you know, identify chimps?
To tag them on Facebook.
Apart from that.
Oh, right. Well, apart from that, you would use facial recognition for conservation purposes to be able to monitor the great apes and or elephants that you're protecting and, you know, very quickly and easily without having to manually trawl through loads and loads of footage, which is kind of what they do at the moment.
So if you've installed cameras in a place that has chimps you want to monitor, what happens if a chimp is just behind a tree? How do you identify him?
You wait until he comes out behind the
You wait until
the
he
tree.
Comes out, and the software is such that it'll be able to work out that that is a chimp, first of all. It will maybe be able to isolate its face, and by the wrinkles and biometric kind of data within the face, then match that to a database, that a pre-existing database that you already have.
So it can say, that's Betty, or that's Max, or
yeah,
whatever.
It should be able to do that.
Betty the chimp.
Betty's still doing well. But what they've added to that is this audio tracking. So they're going to have microphones out in the wilds, and then they can isolate certain noises, like standard noises that great apes make, like pummeling their chests or guttural groans, And they'll be able to link those to the individuals as well to kind of improve the identification process.
You see, I knew there had to be an answer to that question. If the chimp is behind a tree, then you listen to what it's doing behind the tree.
Oh, I see. Well, I think you kind of have to combine that with the visual data. But yes, you can just listen.
So does this system work? Have they tried it?
They've trialed it at Leipzig. Is that how you pronounce it?
Leipzig.
Zoo. But obviously, the conditions were pretty optimal there. But they found it to be around 90% effective, I think. 83% effective.
But that's probably because they have cameras right up against the chimps.
And that was only camera. I don't think that had the audio data. So, but it definitely, it's interesting given that all this sort of tracking is very, very emotionally charged within the human world, but obviously incredibly useful with animals and doesn't kind of come under all the privacy quandaries that people seem to have.
Well, we have one more story to get to before we move away from our news portion and into our feature dessert, which is that... Ubisoft has determined that its Always Online DRM, which we talked about in the past, was a success.
I'm not quite sure how they've come to that conclusion.
This is a system, and I'm not joking. If you buy a game that is to be played offline on your PC, and if your internet connection goes down, even though you're not using the internet, your game will pause. And this was an effort to curb piracy. And they've said it is a success because they saw piracy rates drop after they implemented this.
I think it's probably that they saw piracy rates drop because just nobody was interested in playing their games at all anymore.
It blows my mind that anyone could think that this is a good idea. Even if piracy levels are going down, you are angering all the people who are actually paying for your product, yeah, as opposed to not angering the people who just stole it from BitTorrent.
And what's worse is that the trend is spreading.
It is. Diablo, which is from Blizzard, Activision Blizzard.
Diablo 3.
Is going to have a similar system. And although they say that it's largely to help make sure that online gaming is fair and that people aren't abusing by cheating or whatever, that it's still partly to do with piracy. And it's really frightening that this is becoming a growing trend.
I mean, the way they explained it away, one of the chaps at Blizzard, what was his name? Alex Mabry, said that it's just kind of the way things are these days. The world of gaming isn't the same as it was when Diablo 2 came out, which was back in the early noughties.
That's nonsense.
It is. It's just because it's how things are. It doesn't mean that's the way things should be.
There are so many ways to improve on this. And you've written about it, Duncan. I wrote about it earlier this week.
We all got a little bit angry.
We did. If you search Ubisoft Blizzard on wired.co.uk, you will find probably a number of articles. You'll find, I think mine is the most recent, whinging about this, but also offering up some suggestions for how this could play out. But if you have an opinion about Ubisoft's DRM practice or Diablo from Blizzard, then email us, podcast@wired.co.uk. We really encourage you to, if you have an opinion, because we'll read it out next week. And that's going to wrap up our news section for this week as we move on to our feature in which Katie has explored what is Unbound.
Unbound is a publishing platform that gives the power to put a book on the shelves to the public. Founded by three authors, John Mitchinson, Justin Pollard, and Craptown's author Dan Kieran, the platform allows authors to pitch their tome to the public, who can then choose to pledge funds to make it happen. But what do you get for your money aside from the warm, fuzzy feeling that you've made a humble wordsmith's day? You can promise anything from £10 to the full cost of funding the book, and rewards range from ebook downloads and personally dedicated Unbound first editions to invites to the book launch party and lunch with the author. Authors involved include Amy Jenkins, creator of This Life, and Monty Python star Terry Jones, whose book Evil Machines is the very first to get all of the funding it needs. We spoke to Terry about why he has chosen Unbound, but first up, here's project founder Dan Kieran explaining how Unbound compares with traditional publishing models.
The idea behind it is the brainchild of three authors. I'm a co-founder with John Mitchison and Justin Pollard. And we thought that it was kind of quite shocking, actually, in publishing that there's no way for readers to have any kind of direct say in what does or doesn't get published. And ultimately, the only people that matter, we think, in the process are authors and readers. So we thought, why not bring them together? So that's effectively what Unbound does. So authors pitch an idea for a book they want to write, and we set a kind of target number of supporters. And if the author achieves that number of supporters, then the project goes ahead. And if they don't, then it doesn't.
The project has kicked off with six books, but Dan says there's the potential to host as many as they deem suitable.
Thankfully, we've been offered great books by brilliant authors. I can't tell you who they are now, but they'll be coming up soon. And there are some very big names in there, which is going to cause quite a lot of surprise, I think, amongst traditional publishing. But yeah, we have lots, but essentially it's about quality. If someone sends us something which we think is fantastic, then we'll put it up. We don't have a kind of arbitrary limit or, you know, level of which we're prepared to have. I mean, you know, the more books, the better, I think, frankly. But we think they've got to be of a, you know, of a certain quality, certainly to begin with. And then, you know, then we'll relax it a bit more and make it more about trying, you know, breaking new talent and people trying to just have a punt on a new idea.
Once they have the book, the Unbound team has to decide how much needs to be raised to bring the book into being.
The main thing it depends on is whether the author wants an advance. What we favour are authors who aren't looking for a specific amount of money, and therefore it's just about making the project kind of cost effective to print and produce, because obviously lots of work goes into producing a book in terms of, from our end, it's the website and the pitch videos and all that kind of thing. But what we're trying to do is make that amount of money as low as possible, because then you can do something really interesting. Because if you only need like a couple of hundred people to support a book, then that makes it much more likely that book's going to get to exist. And then subsequently, after the book has been written and you're selling it and you've hit your target, the deal with Unbound is that all authors just get a straight 50% of the profits. And in a conventional publishing deal, they get about 8%. So what we're saying to authors is, don't try not to have a big advance, and it'll make your book more likely to get funded. And then when it does make money, you're going to get half of the money it makes over the lifetime of the book. It's essentially a way of trying to get a book off the ground. And so the biggest obstacle to that is a huge advance. But a lot of authors aren't getting those advances anymore anyway.
For screenwriter, author, actor, film director, political commentator and historian Terry Jones, it was the money that talked.
Quite honestly, it's the split. They're doing it 50-50 or 60-40. I can't remember what it is now. I think it's 50-50 with the author. So the website takes 50% and the author takes 50%, which is a big improvement on the normal publishing thing, where, you know, the publishers take 5%, the author gets 5% or 10%. Traditional publishing is in the doldrums. I mean, it's collapsing, and the publishers are looking around for new ways of going forwards. And I think Unbound is the future. It could be the future. But it's also going back to an old-fashioned way. I mean, Thackeray and Dickens wrote on subscription in this sort of way. So it's got historic roots.
From the past to the future, though, while Dan has hinted that some well-known names have been knocking at their door, Unbound is also going to be championing new authors. But we needed known names for the launch, says Dan.
Let's be honest, if we'd launched with, you know, 50 unknown authors, then, you know, it probably wouldn't have worked. Our plan has always been from the beginning is that you launch with established people that have kind of established audiences that you can get to relatively easily. Like Terry's a classic example, as is Amy, you know, they've both got fan bases. And then you kind of build the idea and you get books successfully funded and you prove the model. And all while we're doing that, it's like Groupon, the bigger our user base becomes. And then once we think we've reached a point where that user base is big enough, then we're going to start doing first-time authors. And we've done a deal with ABC Tales, which is an online creative writing community, where, you know, the best stuff that comes through that website, we're going to put on Unbound to seek funding. And that's something we want to do with all kinds of creative writing communities, because ultimately this is all about breaking new authors. But you have to be realistic about how you try and set these kinds of things up. And, you know, in the future, I imagine Unbound will have one part of the website which is for established authors, and then another part which is much more like an open platform where anyone can put up their pitch video.
Terry has now started penning his book, Evil Machines, which came to him in a Monday moment in his car.
I think I was driving along and I got stopped by a red traffic light, and the word evil machines, the phrase evil machines, came into my head. And I thought, well, that's a good title for a collection of stories. So what I did was I started writing these stories, what's going to happen is that they're going to turn into a whole tale. In fact, actually, you start reading them and you think they're individual stories, but in the end, you discover that they're a complete tailing themselves.
And Terry will be sustained, as he writes, by the lunches he will need to attend, won by those who pledged towards his project.
It was a bit of a surprise for me, that one, when I saw that was one of the rewards. People at Unbound hadn't mentioned that to me. So, I'm sure anybody who subscribes to my book is going to be an intelligent, worthwhile person to meet for lunch.
While the model itself is potentially revolutionary, it is interesting that the Unbound team has not moved completely away from traditional publishing, in that the deal for authors still includes a printed tome. And quite right too, says Dan.
I think ultimately people will want two kinds of books. I know I do. I want a kind of beautiful, wonderful edition on my bookshelf, but I also want to be able to read it on the bus and take it on my Kindle or my iPad, which is why for £20 with Unbound, you get both. But at the same time, we think you should have the flexibility of being able to take it away with you on a train or a bus, which you maybe wouldn't want to do with such a heavy, beautiful book. So we think that's the future. I'm not so sure that the paperbacks will be around for very much longer. I think it's all digital and quality editions. But I also think it depends on the book. I have a Kindle and an iPad, and I read books on both. But I also have a pile of books by my bed, which I kind of trip over, which remind me that I haven't finished reading those yet. And I think what I'm settling into is that certain kinds of books I have digitally and other kinds of books I don't. And I think this is whole new ground. This is a new thing, and it's incredibly exciting time in publishing because of digital. But I think people will settle into different ways of reading. We certainly think beautiful physical objects will always be demanded by people.
If the idea of making a book happen appeals to you, check out the current pitches on unbound.co.uk, and you can still get your name in the back of Terry's title, which will be available this November. Our thanks to both Dan and Terry for joining us.
Katie Scott there, reporting on Unbound, another wonderful feature from Miss Scott, who's not here today because she's not in on a Thursday. That's going to do the show for this week. Duncan, we've got some feedback.
We do. Adam Fisher emailed in and said he was listening to a recent podcast and the mention of Newsbin 2, which we covered. Was it last week?
It was last week.
Last week. This is the precise reason I'm with Virgin Media, he says, and not BT. Not to mention the ACS law kerfuffle. BT handed over their users' IP addresses in the blink of an eye, whereas Virgin gave them the middle finger. Annoyingly, BT also offer a fibre optic connection in my area. I could have it installed tomorrow if I wanted, but no love for Virgin.
So he's really annoyed that BT is going to have to be blocking Newsbin, the Usenet search group.
So annoyed he used the word kerfuffle.
It's a good word.
Also, if anyone listened to the end of the show last week, and that is the end by which we mean after the music, because there's usually a little surprise lurking at the end of that rainbow.
Easter egg.
We ended up talking about Liv, who was drawing a horse for some reason. And we asked people to email in if they heard it, and a bunch of people did. But the first person to was Chris Paul.
Congratulations, Chris.
He asked, has it been found yet? And the answer is yes, by you just then. So, Chris,
Percy the horse.
You win a picture of this horse thing that Liv was doodling instead of doing any kind of work last week. Thanks for that, Liv. Drop us an email, podcast@wire.co.uk, with your address. We'll send it out and send you a magazine or something. Also, Churchy wrote in. Don't know what his real name is. Maybe that is his real name.
He's called Churchy.
Is that a real name?
Maybe he's a vicar.
I don't know.
I hope not. They said, just thought I'd email to say that I caught the end of the podcast 36 with Percy the Secret Podcast Horse. Sorry you didn't win it, I'm afraid, Churchy. But he said, mainly it gives me an excuse to finally email through to show my appreciation for the countless hours of factual entertainment. They've helped me on my long, arduous walks to college and work and have become a comforting treat for my ears. Thank you, Wired.UK podcast team. You're welcome.
You are Churchy. So welcome. Yeah. I'm in your ears right now. And if you want to send us an email and be one of these fine fellows that we talk about at the end of our show, send us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. But that's not the only way to get in touch, is it, Liv?
No, it's not. You can also follow us on Twitter, and we're on @wiredUK.
We've got a kick-ass Facebook page as well, facebook.com/wiredUK. You should go over there, leave us some love. Someone sent us a picture of their cat licking one of our magazines. That's on there. Maybe your cat could be.
There's also a whole ton of horrific video game ice cream puns that were collected by people. That was quite a treat. My favourite was Altered Feast.
I missed that one.
That was really good.
That was brilliant. Yeah, we have a lot of fun on there. So facebook.com/wiredUK. Go and hit us up. And until next week, continue to be excellent to each other.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I had a banana for breakfast.
Have a banana.
Mm, I did. I peeled it like a chimp. It was just laying on my desk looking pathetic like a little dead hitchhiker, so I thought I'd eat it. I don't know. I've never seen a dead hitchhiker. I have no idea. Should we start the show?